It's a privilege to be here today and to talk to you and many of you, Sean, Shauna, John Betcher, that Chris Thompson, you're out there somewhere, that we've worked with on these sites. My presentation is going to pick up where the other folks have stopped, which was this precedence of voluntary programs being created in the early 1990s. Minnesota was the first state in the union to do it, to try and start to redevelop some of these Superfund sites. Inner ring cities, mayors, politicians were saying, hey, we can't grow anymore. We have no more cornfields to plow over. We need to redevelop these sites and start getting new jobs and tax base to keep our communities growing. And that's when the redevelopment program started, and it all boils back to that Land Recycling Act in the mid-1990s. As we went through that Land Recycling Act, we started to be able to look at the redevelopment of some of the toughest sites, these Superfund sites, and I'll highlight four of them today for you that we've worked on or are working on. Our company was started by my dad and I out of his experience working on redeveloping sites for a couple of developers. Early, the first two programs that went through the Land Recycling Act, and we've been doing it for 19 years since. We've done about 2 million square feet of new development over those 19 years. Four of those were federal listed sites, which we're going to talk about today. And here's some of the benefits. This is some good news after some of the tough stuff we heard earlier. We've probably just, these projects have added about 2,000 new jobs to these blighted sites, $125 million in new development. And a big part of that is leveraging over $50 million in state grants and tax increment from communities to help these voluntary cleanups come to life. So let's look at four of these sites. I think you talked about some of the wood treating sites. We're going to talk about two of them that we redeveloped. Al's company was involved in both. The first is the former Jocelyn site in Brooklyn Center. Here's a great aerial picture of the wood treating site in operation. And Al, I think we got this picture from you years ago. This is a great photo because you can see some of the wood treating chemicals dripping off the wood. And of course, this was a sandy site and all that stuff went straight down, which caused significant groundwater problems. And the responsible party in this case, Jocelyn, working with Barr, performed their Superfund cleanup. But here's what it's like when they were done. They'd done some land treatment, bioremediation of the site. They had a DNAPL extraction system, a groundwater system. But the site still had this keep out and needed an industrial use to close out the last phase of the cleanup of the site. As I said, the site had been remediated to the standards of the mid-1980s. This is something also that we heard about from Al. It remained on the Superfund list, both on the federal and state list. There were some new cleanup standards. Specifically, we're looking at dioxins and furans here. Those standards kept changing. We had a groundwater treatment system in place, pumping and treating for question mark number of years, still working. We had buried debris with impacted soil in the way of our development. And although the soils had been remediated, they weren't compactable enough to suit new development. So we still had work to do. This is a picture of my dad with a representative of Jocelyn. That's my buddy Carl Grabinski. This is the spoon test. And what you did out at that particular time is you'd put a bit of soil in a spoon, put some water on it. If you saw the rainbow, no good. It's polluted. Standards have changed.
Very accurate.
It worked. But standards have changed between that cleanup and what we were going to be doing here starting in the late 1990s and 2000. The first thing we always start with on these projects is the redevelopment plan. What's the end use? Forget the cleanup. Forget what the site looks like today. What are we going to put there? Because if the market doesn't support our end-use development, you're never going to make this redevelopment plan work. So the first thing we did is look at how we could develop the site into a four-building industrial park. The Jocelyn site that we were working on is this pie-shaped piece here. So we had to acquire 1, 2, 3, 4 extra parcels in order to make the redevelopment feasible. This is the first building going on here. What we're doing is digging up the land treatment unit and recompacting it. Why were we doing that? Because the bioremediation system didn't want compacted soils. It wouldn't work as well. we needed compacted soils in order to support our buildings. We also had to make sure our utility corridors and green spaces had clean soil, so there was a lot of soil shuffling going on. And you can see some pictures of that here. We also had to essentially rebuild the groundwater system. Why is that? Because we couldn't have groundwater system pipes running under buildings, across buildings, in the way of our development. So once we landed on what the development was going to be, then we could figure out how to reconfigure the groundwater system. And this wasn't the RP's problem. This was our problem. This is one of those costs that falls on the redevelopment. Here we are rebuilding that system, headed into the oil water separator. We also wanted to make sure all of our stormwater ponds were lined, so that whatever we did in terms of the new development and stormwater that was coming on site wouldn't start making the groundwater system work differently than it had been designed for. And lastly, vapors. Yes, they were back in 1999. We were still worried about vapors. In this case, we had an underfloor vent system that had a sand cushion with perforated pipe that vented up through the roof. Here's the blower that we could run either on a passive or active mode. Either with the fan on or just the wind blowing could make it work. And we designed that into our first building on the site. I forget what the chemical was. I think it was the naphthalene that was, smells like mothballs. We didn't want that going into the building. We have to make sure we address all those concerns to get companies that had had 20 years of worried about staying out of these sort of sites to actually pay me to be on one. And here's our first building. We completed in 2000. Second one in 2001. This is the Caribou Coffee headquarters. That was 2004. And the last building we just completed last year across the street in 2012. Over 550 new jobs on this site that had zero jobs. In a little community like Brooklyn Center, that's a really big deal. And over $45 million in new property tax base. Again, for a little city like Brooklyn Center, they need all that tax base to help keep paying the bills. What did we learn from working on this site? We had to design our project, once we figured out the end use, around that existing groundwater treatment and DNAPL extraction system. So we'd move buildings around things that we couldn't move, like the DNAPL system. We also needed to acquire more land to make the site developable. Very rarely is the Superfund site in a shape that actually lends itself to development. And there was still tons of work to do even after the responsible party had completed its obligations. Finally, this was the first of the Superfund sites that we got delisted. That was a big deal, taking it off the list. It looks like something happened, and this we had some great work done by both John Betcher and Jerry Stonke and Michael Kanner helping us get that first site delisted. It makes the banks a lot happier. It makes the lawyers that work for the tenants happier to see that that progress is going on. And then this was the first time we'd started to think about vapor intrusion. It's a big deal today, but it was on our minds back then. Now we'll look at the National Lead site, the second of our sites we'll look at. And these black and white pictures are just awesome. Here's this National Lead site in St. Louis Park. This is Highway 7. And then right over here is Louisiana. This is the new Sam's Club right now, right here on that intersection. Here's the National Lead site. All sorts of lead dust coming out of this thing. And there's a Little League field right next to it. That just still blows me away. Not a good idea. We had, here's the National Lead site. Another look at the map here. Here's Highway 7. I think, Al, you referred to the Riley Tar site. Kitty corner right across the street from where we were. And what you'll see here is we had all sorts of lead contamination from the former smelter. The remedy in place was to cover it with a parking lot. But we were going to start to touch all that stuff as we put in our new building. We also found from the old junkyard that operated next door, hey, it was a good idea to bury stuff for them too, I guess. So we found all sorts of car parts, maybe a dead German Shepherd or two, all buried under the parking lot when we came upon the site. Again, we arrived at our redevelopment plan, figuring out what we could build there that the market would support. Again, site assembly, what a funky shaped site. The depths weren't right, it was oddly shaped, so we had to acquire a road, which had a dead end. This green parcel was tax forfeited. we had two other buildings we had to acquire here, and then the city's impound lot was operating back here, and they made us find a home for them. Not the easiest thing to do to keep them in the same city. That's the kind of work that has nothing to do with the cleanup, but we have to do to make these kind of projects happen. Once we got about doing that, we started with our demolition. There were all sorts of old pavements from the smelter operation out there. Again, that's really typical. Just because it's cleaned up didn't mean they got rid of the old machine foundations and infrastructure on the site. Then you find things like underground tanks. And here's the lead-impacted soil. And we had a really novel system we created with the agency and with the help of Chris Thompson to mix this compound in there that would bind the lead to the soil molecules so it wouldn't be as mobile. This was something that we did, the RP never had to do, but we did in order to get our cleanup done. We were super vigilant on worker safety because the lead levels were so high there. We monitored dust, we took workers' blood samples constantly to make sure that no one was getting exposed. And when we were done, we ended up with this new building, which added about $3 million in tax base and or $10 million in new tax base and 350 new jobs to that site in St. Louis Park. What did we learn from the National Lead site? Well, there was a remedy, but it was simply a parking lot over a demolished lead smelter, and that left all sorts of work for us to do once we pulled that remedy off. Again, we needed to acquire adjacent land to make our site developable. We looked hard. Wasn't there a way to get some of this lead-impacted soil off the site? I really thought that would be easier to explain to folks, but it was tens of millions of dollars more to dig it up, send it to a landfill, bring back clean sand, when in effect we could stabilize it on site and cover it with a parking lot. That's the only way the project happened, with that remedy. And on this site as well, we had to get the delisting done in order to get, what a transition from the original Superfund program, actual money from EPA to help clean up the site through the APA loan program administered by Hennepin County indeed. A third wood treating site, another one that Al's company worked on, this is the Boise Onan site in Fridley. It was a large former wood treating site right behind a Cummins engineering building. There was an adjacent vault and groundwater French drain system on site, and that vacant land needed to be developed by Cummins. We came across the site. We did the same sort of things. The story here is some of those buried drums didn't make it to the guy's farm. They actually buried them on site. We did a very thorough investigation and just missed this because it was an 8-foot-wide trench through a 30-acre site. And you could actually see the labels on the barrels and know that it was right around Rickwood when somebody dug a hole and put them in the ground. And after that was cleanup was completed, we redeveloped the site with a 400,000-foot distribution center that added about $16 million in new tax base. The lesson learned on this one, we still needed it to get delisted, but the original remedy left surprises, and that's something we always plan for. Finally, a site we're working on today. This site has many names. We're working on it with Shauna and John right now. It might be called the FMC site, the NIROP site in Fridley. 122 acres right along the Mississippi River at 694, which is up here, and East River Road. This 122-acre site has a functionally obsolete building. It has a marvelous history dating back to the Second World War, where it was built to build gun turrets for Navy battleships, cruisers, and destroyers. There used to be 3,500 people there. Most of those jobs were moved to Kentucky and Michigan, and so there are only 500 folks left working on the site. The main tenant, a successor to FMC, is BAE, that's British Aerospace, and this 122-acre site is paying less real estate taxes than our 40-acre Joslyn site in Brooklyn Center, three times the size, orders of magnitude less on the real estate taxes, and that gives you some sense of why Fridley is so interested in redeveloping it. The largest redevelopment site within the 494-694 loop. Similar existing conditions to the other projects, remediated to the ROD standards. There were actually two Superfund sites here. This is a little funky. Up here is a site that's run by the Navy. This is the Navy site. Down here you'll see a vault. This is the site that's operated by FMC's successor, British Aerospace. There were still an existing groundwater treatment system in place, pumping water, keeping it out of the river. That's going to operate for we don't know how much longer, a long time. There's a bunch of buried debris with impacted soil that we ran across, and a new interest in chlorinated solvents, TCE, as well as the vapor issue. The first thing we did again is develop this site plan to redevelop the site, figure out what buildings want to go there, and then work our cleanup around those. Here's the first building that's actually under construction right now. That'll be done in about 6 weeks. The first of 12 buildings in a 5 to 7 year redevelopment horizon. And what we're going to do here is do each investigation, cleanup, and assurance certificate of completion by building. There's no way we can clean up and redevelop the whole site at once. We can't deliver that much redevelopment at once. So we're going to go, we divided it into four phases, and by building, we'll be doing our cleanup and our assurances. Why is this a good idea? Well, it finishes what's going on out there in terms of the cleanup. For the first time ever, we'll be able to tear this thing down and maybe get some source areas underneath that building addressed. And we'll also be able to deliver up to 3,500 new jobs back to the site, replacing those that have left, $125 million in new property tax base, leading to about $2.5 million a year in new property taxes. To a city like Fridley, that's a really big deal. We're going to hit all the LEED requirements for our buildings, prairie restoration for the landscaping, and then as important to these communities, in terms of sustainability of the building, we want sustainable tenants. So instead of one tenant that leaves and all of a sudden the thing's empty, we want to have like a diverse stock portfolio, 25 to 35 tenants that will weather all sorts of economic storms and still keep jobs on the site. This was an interesting site. We had success after time getting folks out of the Superfund paradigm, and what I would characterize that as so many years in that same sort of mode of relating to each other, we had to get the RPs in particular convinced, the Navy and BAE, to, hey, let's play ball with these folks. We had trips to Chicago to Region 5, and after some great work, got EPA to defer to the VIC program here. That's the only way this project worked, is by those folks, frankly, deferring and staying out of the way. They're not as used to this voluntary cleanup as the folks at VIC are, who are really good at it. In a similar manner, we had VIC take the lead on the state side, too. And that's how we're cruising through this project. We're going to need delisting. I think we've already got a big piece of that done, and that's essential for financing it, and we're going to try and get some more EPA money here coming up to help pay for our redevelopment work. As you've heard from starting with Al and then Jim, we've come a long way. We're now talking about buying these sites, not running away from them. We're talking about getting people to loan money on these sites, which was unheard of years ago. We have large companies with deep balance sheets paying us money to be on these sites, which is remarkable. And then we're actually getting people to buy them from us, which is a testament to the creativity of the folks in this room and the engineering folks that we've worked on to be able to make this happen. And the big benefit here is this helps these infill communities, as well as the environment, move into the next century. Concerns about the future, I think we've heard both Jim and Al talk about that, changing standards, both on the vapor intrusion and the cleanup standards for TCE. That's a natural thing when you have standards that date to the 80s, and now all of a sudden we've got better science, better technology. We have to be nimble to incorporate that into our projects. And then this is the one no one's talked about, at least, social media. We've got this group on Facebook called the Fridley Cancer Cluster. None of them live in Fridley. And they're convinced of all sorts of conspiracies out there, including that I'm really related to FMC, and I'm a successor to some British conspiracy to avoid liability on the site. That's the kind of stuff you can't defeat when it's out there on Facebook, but it's a real issue for us in our development. And the idea of explaining risk and Fridley cancer cluster and the presence of smokers, according to Department of Health data versus what's actually going on the site, that's something I never thought about when we were going to start working on these. That's it for me. I'm happy to answer any questions with Al and Jim.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Paul. We've got about 10 minutes here, I think, so can take a few questions. I'll take them and hand them off. No questions? Okay.
Back there. Yes, you do.
It's Gil Gabansky.
There was a lot of RFPs that went after your insurance policies
to get cost recovery, and
right.
There was always
these big arguments about sudden and accidental.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about how that got handled by the courts?
Only a little, because it's not an area that I. It was an area that I worked on very briefly, and then delegated it off to other lawyers. It was obviously another one of the big institutional changes was the effect on the Superfund on insurers. Generally, what people were doing was looking back when they were being held retroactively liable or held liable for things that had happened in the past. They would pull out their old comprehensive general liability policies and say, well, you know, this covers me because I was covered by this policy back in that year. The insurance companies, I think there was always a sort of standard clause in those that said that they would only cover sudden and accidental issues, so that if something were an ongoing problem, I think insureds were expected to have figured that out and stopped it. So there was a lot of debate over whether these policies covered slow leakage of hazardous substances from buried drums, for example. The insurance companies obviously quickly began putting pollution exclusions into their policies to eliminate that. But I don't know that I can tell you what the rule of law is. It probably is going to vary by jurisdiction and by various case, but that's what the dispute was about. You know, there was always due diligence, in the sense that if a company were buying another company, you would do financial due diligence or other due diligence. Environmental due diligence was a new, subject for due diligence. Not the concept itself wasn't new, but looking at that, those kind of things were.
We have a grant that was through a project that we're going to use EPA money on it, and we submitted an eligibility application to the EPA. This entity had acquired property in 1952, and the EPA turned around and said they didn't do their due diligence for environmental causes. There was no money.
Right. There was no environmental due diligence in 52, right? Right, exactly. Well, that's EPA, you know.
Hi, I actually don't have a question, but a shameless plug for the poster session, one of which you can see the hybrid sediment remedy that came out of the peer review team process that Jim described on the Interlake or SlideRight site up in Duluth.
Other questions?
I have a question for Paul.
It really helps to use the microphone.
I have a question for Paul, which is that what possessed you and your father to think that this would be a good business opportunity instead of doing greenfields development like other developers?
I was young and stupid.
That doesn't count for your father, though.
No, that he was the opposite. I think the idea was... he had done legal work for the City of St. Louis Park and Frauenschuh for the first voluntary cleanup site in the state, which was at Excelsior Boulevard and Highway 100. And I was a lawyer, went to law school. I didn't care for it. Shocking. I think I lasted 6 months, maybe. And the idea was, boy, if we can help these communities and, you know, be not terrified of the risk and it was a much bigger risk back then. Maybe we've got something, and then it just kept working.
Mr. Lee, I have a question.
I forgot about the VDOL, the first version of Merlin.
I don't think so, but I, you know, that's so far in the past to me that I can't really remember. I think that perhaps the provision allowing for lawsuits for personal injury might have been added the second time around. I just can't remember, you know. We could find the session laws and compare, but I'm not that interested. So,
was it the same governor?
Well, it was. It couldn't. He vetoed it in 1982, and then it was passed in 1983. So it must have been the same governor. I think different lobbyists, perhaps.
Sure.
Paul, you've done work.
Hi, Gil.
You've done work in other states for cleanup of brownfield sites. Do you see the funding mechanisms available elsewhere as we have here in Minnesota?
It's a great question. We have a site going on in North Dakota right now, and to describe their regulatory program with what I'm used to with Minnesota it's hard, because we talk about, we want a no association letter, we want approvals for our investigation, and no, we don't do that. It's like, well, am I going to get in trouble? Probably not. So you're sort of in this no man's land, no person's land, and then there's no money. There's no grant funding up there, and I'm going to be and have been educating the Fargo City Council on the fact that it's time for them as a maturing community to start looking at reusing sites. But the impulse there is just keep going out. But there are some folks that are open to that, and that's going to be probably 5 to 10 years to get that regulatory program mature, and then most importantly, get the money to pay for it. Because without that, the cleanups don't happen.
The Friendly Cancer Cluster you were talking about, I know that they became a Superfund.
Thank you. I know that they became a Superfund community advisory group. Were you involved with that at all, or do you know how they are? They're supposedly reviewing the cleanup of, I think they have 5 sites in Fridley.
They have a picture of Aaron Brockovich on their Facebook page, for what that's worth. We've been presenting to them monthly updates, and we're going to be coming up here shortly with our next phase of our redevelopment, presenting our cleanup plan that the agency approved here on November 1.
Is the city approval of your development, are they getting involved in that too then?
No. One of the city council members, excuse me, one of the HRA members sits on the community advisory group, though.
In recent campaigns, we hear a lot of rhetoric about how environmental protection is a pox on the economy of our country. Everyone in this room probably feels differently about that. It hasn't killed our jobs. But from a national perspective, do you believe that environmental regulation is good for this country, or it's overdone, or it's bad for this country? Where do you lie on that issue?
Who are you addressing?
Who wants that one?
You want to go for it?
No, go ahead.
It depends. A good lawyer answer. But I think it does. I'm like you, and I've made my living in the environmental area. I remember being home from college on Earth Day, the real Earth Day, which probably many of you can't remember or weren't born yet. And I remember my mom and dad had friends over, and they were saying, "Oh, this environmental stuff, it's going to blow over in another year," you know. Well, it isn't. I do think, and by and large, I don't think there necessarily needs to be a conflict between environment and the economy. I think that in specific instances, the regulators can go overboard and often do, and part of what we do is push back. You know? But the real issue is reasonable regulation, not no regulation, I think.
Yeah, I guess what I mean, my view is that the various laws and programs are certainly well intentioned and certainly are valuable. But, you know, when you're a practitioner and you get into some of the details and you see that, you know, we're cleaning up sites to a 1 × 10⁻⁶ cancer risk, for example, when your normal risk of cancer is 1 in 2 and 1 in 3, I mean, it does seem like we're spending a lot of money for not much risk reduction sometimes. On the other hand, the programs are certainly well-intentioned.
There was a study from EPA probably 20 years ago where they asked experts to rank environmental risk, people who were knowledgeable, and they ranked perhaps 20 to 30 different risks, and then they compared those risks with how EPA was actually spending money, and there was no relationship.
Paul, do you have anything to add to that?
We get tenants because we've cleaned up sites. We get companies that want to do that now. On our Joslin site with a wood treating chemicals that's got a groundwater extraction system and a DNAPL system, we've got a Swiss-based company that sells camping gear for water purification, freshwater water purification called Katadin. What sold the Swiss CEO was seeing Al's system out there, and they're like, well, that's what we do. So, Caribou Coffee, they're on a polluted site. Toro, some of the great Minnesota companies. So, it's a benefit if handled properly.
You want to do one more question, Eric? Or?
I thought I saw one over here. Okay,
go ahead.
Yeah, Al, you brought up something that resonated with me, and that is the more you study some of these sites, the more complex they get. And this program has developed more higher resolution testing per acre than anything in the country. And so my rhetorical question to the group, and maybe it's a good question for later on, is how many PhD and master's thesis have we developed over this knowledge of this high resolution hydrogeology and chemistry?
Probably a lot, for sure. I got my master's in hydraulic engineering, though, so I came before all this. It's something to think about, though.